Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last summer, we spoke with Joel Christian Gill about Strange Fruit and The Talented Tenth, two comic book series which shine a light on the lives of uncelebrated or largely unknown African-American figures from American history. Joel is just the kind of guy you'd read about or hear on radio or TV during Black History Month. Instead, he's mounting a campaign against Black History Month. He says that dedicating the shortest month of the year to Black history is wrong and has started the hashtag 28 days are not enough to get others on board. We spoke to Joel the day after the Martin Luther King holiday. He'd just gotten off a plane from San Francisco. So Joel, how did you come up with this campaign? 28 days are not enough.
So my sister, I was doing an interview over the summer talking about Strange Fruit, and I was my sister was live tweeting me exactly as I was doing this interview. And I said something to the effect of, we need to celebrate Black history 365 days out of the year. And she said, I'm with you because 28 days are not enough. And I said, I like the way that sounds. I'm going to steal it and I'm going to use it. So if my sister's listening, Tiffany, I love you. Thank you for giving me the idea. And that became sort of the rallying cry for why I make books, because I made these books because they're interesting and I like the stories. And so I started thinking, well, why am I making these books? Why are they important? And it got me thinking about the idea that the African-American story is the American story. It is the quintessential American story. It's the bootstraps Americans. Like, that's the Black experience, right? You pull yourself up because nobody's going to help you.
Mm-hmm. So it's not Black history. It's American history.
It's American history. And, you know, we don't celebrate. Why would we celebrate these type of people, these people who epitomize what the American values are, for just one month?
Well, of course, there's a counter-argument, right, that if we didn't designate Black History Month, we wouldn't be teaching kids about Rosa Parks or Malcolm X in the schools.
Right. And, well, and see, that's the thing. That's the thing that I think is scary to some people, because I tell them we should get rid of Black History Month, and they're like, well, our history will be diluted, and people won't. And I'm like, no, our history won't be diluted. We will have to take up the charge. You know, Black History Month was started in 1926 when Carter G. Woodson gave a sort of purpose to Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln's birthday. It's because Black people had been celebrating that all the time. So he's like, well, let's take that week and we'll call that Negro History Week. Mm-hmm. And then during the Black Power Movement, the Black Student Union at Kent State proposed changing it into a month. Like, we're going to make this Black History Month. And it seemed like, when you look at this, it seems like it's a victory when Gerald Ford recognized Black History Month in 1976. But what the unintended consequence is that I only get invited to go talk to schools during Black History Month, or we only talk about these people during Black History Month. And the reason my stories and the stuff in my book are obscure is because we don't get to talk about. By the time we get past Rosa Parks and Malcolm X and Dr. King and George Washington Carver, there's no more time. We go back to quote unquote regular history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the thing that separates us. That's the thing that makes us into them. And, you know, that's the thing I'm advocating. I think that by celebrating our shared history, it will unite us take one step in uniting us to separate us from the us and the them. When white Americans and Asian Americans can look at Black history and say, I really get that. That's part of my heritage because I am an American, it will take away that idea that there's a other. And so there's no better way than this to accept that is to say that we are one people with one history.
Well, you brought up so many interesting things just then. And one is, how literally are you taking this? I mean, are you sort of boycotting Black History Month? If somebody says to you, will you come be a guest on my show today for Black History Month, are you going to say no?
No. a former professor of mine said, you know, whenever you get a chance to talk about it, say we should expand the narrative. If I'm going to come, that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about why we should not be, this should not be the only time we celebrate Black artists or Black professionals or Black speakers. Like, we should be expanding the narrative and sort of changing it. Like, let's talk about something else. Let's talk about, you know, the idea that, you know, Americans survive. You know, when Herbert Hoover coined rugged individualism, he was talking about a group of people in the American frontier. But I think the metaphor for the American frontier is better applied to the frontier and the barren wasteland that was American racism at the time for Black people. It's an amazing thing that, you know, Major Taylor, who was the first black world champion in any sport, was able to be a, you know, a successful black man in the 1920s. Like, that's an amazing thing. Because, you know, that thing that black people had to work twice as hard to be second place, mm-hmm. and these people became first. In some instances, they were the best.
Right, so this is the Horatio Alger story. This is the story of success, but we don't hear that these are American heroes necessarily.
Right, because they become those people's
right.
history.
Right, right.
They're, you know, little kids are not taught that Thurgood Marshall or Frederick Douglass or anyone who has come from a small thing to a great thing are part of the American story. That's part of black history. That's when we're gonna celebrate that. We're gonna put a sign in the library, and we're gonna show you My Life as a Slave or whatever during those times, and we're gonna talk about black history. But we're not gonna talk about it in the context of the American story, because I think that's the most important part of it, because these stories don't happen anywhere else. They don't happen in Europe. They don't happen in South America. They don't happen in Canada. They happen in America, and they are American stories.
Well, now you've been going all over the country yourself talking about 28 days is not enough.
Right.
But, you know, I saw you at the TEDx Amiskeg Milliard, and you joked that, you know, when you leave New Hampshire, the black population goes down, right? You know,
right.
like the percentages change. So here in New Hampshire, a place where people don't have a lot of experience of African-American culture, are they more willing to kind of eat this up than, you know, someplace like Richmond? You're going to Philly later this
yeah.
month, where there is a long history and a much larger African-American community. I'm just wondering, like, how people are responding to this.
It's funny. It's different in different places. I was just in San Francisco at the Northern California Martin Luther King Foundation. I was a special guest for the Black Comics Art Festival, the inaugural Black Comics Arts Festival. And the thing that was great about it is that it was a very diverse crowd. You know, usually you go to a black something and it's predominantly black. And it was just so, like, I'm having, you know, conversations with little, like, Asian American ladies about black history being celebrated. And they're like, right on, like, let's go. Like, they are, like, really into it. And then I go to a place like, I was in Madison, Wisconsin over the summer. You know, I gave the 28 Days Are Not Enough talk, and I talked about how we should get rid of black history. And a woman was like, could you tell us what it was like being a black man in the South? Like, it was like an alien place. Yesterday when I was in San Francisco, somebody said, the place where he grew up was so white and homogenous that nobody said anything bad about black people. And I told him, I'm like, well, that's because white was the default.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no other people to talk about. So part of, you know, white privilege is not understanding that there's anything else. And so you have to sort of think about it and sort of internalize it. And so it's different in different places. Like, I found that in places where, like in New Hampshire, where there are not a lot of black people, it's just like that. We don't talk about it. It's like nobody says anything bad about black people because there are not that many black people to talk about. I remember, you know, when I first moved up here, I had two instances. One, there was a guy who wrote a racist thing to the union leader, and it was like a comment like how he was going to go and celebrate Black History Month by doing what black people did. And this guy was in huts, like he was going to go and, like, what, he was going to take, accept welfare or something. Like, it was something ridiculous. And I started to break that down a little bit, and I'm like, you live in Hudson, New Hampshire. There's probably four black people in Hudson, New Hampshire, is what I'm thinking to myself. Like, you probably have never spent any time with black people. And so, like, what's your frame of reference for, like, disliking black people? And so that's, like, a really interesting thing. Like, why? Like, how could you do that in New Hampshire? But I find that it's interesting. I think the most resistance I get is from black people about let's get rid of Black History Month, because they think that I'm advocating for a homogenization of history. And in a little way, in some ways I am. But what I'm more talking about and what I'm hoping, and this is my grand hope and idea, that if we can embrace the idea that black history is an American history, we can start to change the idea that black people are the exotic other. And if we can change that, then we can all accept that. And it won't be one of those things where, you know, that black kid with the gray hoodie on is a black kid. He's one of our kids. He's an American kid. He's this American kid that was just wandering around, not just like one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they should be one of us. And I think that we should think about it in those terms. And if we can figure out and start to accept black history as part of American history, then, well, I won't need 28 days or not enough.
How do you know when you're done with this campaign?
I will know that I'm done when people want to talk about black history in September. When black artists are not only invited to have shows during Black History Month. When there are no more obscure stories for me to tell, that's when we've, like, understood. Because we've expanded the narrative. We've expanded the idea. Like, I won't only have to talk about obscure black history. Because I'll say, have you heard about Bass Reeves? And everybody go, yeah, I've heard about Bass Reeves.
Joel Christian Gill, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me back.
In January, by the way.
I know, in
And
January.
We did have you on in the summer.
Yep.
We're apparently on the Vanguard.
Yeah, you were on the Vanguard.
He's Dean of Student Affairs at the New Hampshire Institute of Art and the mind behind The Strange Fruit, Uncelebrated Narratives from Black History, and Talented 10th comic book series. You can find more on 28 Days Are Not Enough at wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from Black history to the history of vaccinations. Up next, a look back at a fashion campaign that targeted anti-vaxxers in 18th century France. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In April of 1774, France was a hub for the arts, for geopolitics, for fashion, certainly, and within the King's Court at Versailles, for smallpox. More than 50 people were infected, including King Louis XV himself, as smallpox waged its own reign of terror. After inoculation was introduced to the royal family, the disease was fought with an unlikely weapon, a headdress. All the crowns and costumery in the world did not prevent a measles outbreak last month originating at Disneyland that has hit 85 people and 7 states, and the toll is still climbing. The outbreak is being blamed on unvaccinated people walking around in a closed environment, even one advertised as the happiest place on earth. Kimberly Chrisman Campbell wrote about how fashion helped promote inoculation and defeat smallpox, and how fashion could be useful in today's debate over vaccinations. Kimberly, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, so there was this scourge of smallpox in the mid to late 18th century in Europe. When was inoculation introduced?
Well, inoculation was introduced to Europe in about 1718 by Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who was the English ambassadress to Turkey. She witnessed inoculation in Constantinople, thought this was a great idea that she then introduced to London society upon her return. However, it wasn't immediately accepted. It was still quite controversial as late as 1774 in France.
So smallpox landed in the court of Versailles, and King Louis XV died of smallpox. Right after that, the entire line of succession was inoculated. So what was the procedure for smallpox inoculation at that time?
Well, in order to be inoculated against smallpox, you actually had to get smallpox. And that was the controversial part of it. Improperly performed, inoculation could actually give you full-blown smallpox and eventually kill you, even. So people were naturally scared of this because it was a risky procedure. However, a very small dose of the pus of an infected smallpox sufferer under the skin could give you a very mild case that would then leave you immune to smallpox forever.
So what's the difference in inoculation and vaccination?
The smallpox vaccine actually used cowpox rather than smallpox, which is a much milder form of the disease that was transferred from cows to people. Edward Jenner realized that being infected with cowpox made you then immune to smallpox.
Okay, so it was coming from another source. So the public probably agrees that the process of transferring pus and infecting someone potentially sounded pretty grisly and pretty scary. Now, out of this came the wonderfully named pouf à l'inoculation. What was that?
This was a headdress that alluded to the benefits of inoculation. It had the medical serpent of Asclepius. It had a club representing conquest, a rising sun to represent the new king, and a flowering olive branch symbolizing the peace and joy that were expected to result from the royal inoculation. And the king was now immune to smallpox. That would never happen again where France would lose a king to this deadly disease.
Okay, so I'm thinking that sort of Marie Antoinette, you know, wig that sort of reaches all the way up to the heavens.
That's right. These are very tall, very elaborate hairstyles.
So is it just women who wore the pouf?
It was just women that wore the pouf. In the 17th century, clothing was very expensive relative to what it costs today. We have sewing machines and man-made fibers and things like that. But back then, hats and hairstyles could be updated pretty cheaply and easily. So they were where women were able to express their opinions and thoughts. Women did not have a voice in the government. They didn't have a voice in the church, the military, academia. But they were very well-educated and well-read, at least in the aristocratic and upper middle classes. And they did have opinions, which they tended to express through their hair.
So this really became a trend, the pouf à l'inoculation?
That was one of many poofs. There were poofs inspired by plays, by political scandals, by literature, and by scientific developments. I mean, this was popular culture at the time and a very exciting and, you know, life-changing scientific advance.
But this was not a fashion that reached the great unwashed masses, les sans-culottes, as they called them in France at the time. This was just inside of the aristocracy that inoculation was being pushed?
Well, these fashions were worn by the elite women of society. However, in Paris especially, they were seen in the streets. They were reproduced in fashion plates. I mean, there was a much wider market for these fashions. Even if women could not wear them, they saw them out and about.
Well, back to today, there's still a debate raging about whether or not to vaccinate people, kids especially, we must say. There are a lot of fear and danger about that. And there are places where it is decidedly fashionable not to vaccinate kids. Now, you identified some fashion trends that are revolving around today's pro and even anti-vaccine debate. What are they?
Well, that's right. In the 18th century, you would express your opinions through your hats and hairstyles. Today, it tends to be T-shirts and baseball caps that we use. And again, they're fairly disposable. They're easy to update and to put a slogan on. So there are a lot of pro-vax and anti-vax T-shirts out there already. And more of those might make a difference in this ongoing debate.
What do some of them say?
My favorite one is for a child, and it says, fully vaccinated, you're welcome.
You also identify one with a syringe with the label weapon of mass destruction, or no shots,
yes.
No school, not true.
There are a lot of those. The syringe and the weapon of mass destruction is a popular theme. And there's also a whole genre of shirts devoted to the idea that the vaccines themselves aren't bad. It's just the chemicals in the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. So no thank you. You can keep the autism. I mean, this is a pretty bitter battle, and it's been going on for some time. I mean, as a fashion historian, are there other times where fashion was used as propaganda in such a direct way besides the Court of Versailles and these kind of T-shirts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the French Revolution was fought through fashion in many ways, and we've seen that again in multiple wars. We see people wearing yellow ribbons, pink ribbons. There are ribbons for everything these days. There's the Live Strong bracelet. There are a lot of these movements that have really caught on and have taken advantage of the fashion's power to communicate. It is a very powerful form of communication without saying a word, you can get your message across to a lot of people.
I imagine that would be a pretty tough assignment to try and make vaccines cool, you know?
I think now's the time to do it, especially here in California where I live. People are scared to go to Disneyland. People are rushing to get their kids vaccinated because suddenly this abstract threat has become very real. Measles has always, you know, been out there, although 20 years ago it was actually eradicated here, but it's now a much more immediate threat than it was. For example, when my oldest child is 7, we put him on a delayed vaccine schedule because he was born right at the time of all the controversy and debate about the MMR vaccine, and there was really no conclusive proof either way. However, with my younger child, he's been vaccinated for everything as early as possible, just because that is a very real threat now. And because there's so many more parents not vaccinating their children, there's a much higher risk for him.
So this measles outbreak at Disneyland certainly caught a lot of people's attention. What really take for people to start taking this seriously, even if they don't live in California?
Well, this Disneyland outbreak has now spread to several states and countries, and I think people are taking it seriously. I think a large outbreak like this is what it might take. Unfortunately, a few deaths might also get attention. Let's hope that doesn't happen. But that I've always thought that once these diseases became real threats, that people might start paying attention and get their children vaccinated. As far as what fashion can do, I love the idea of people normalizing vaccination by putting these T-shirts on their kids or wearing the one that says, love your kids, have them shot. That's another fun one. What would really do it, though, is if the celebrity class, the elite class, as in the 18th century, would adopt these fashions and really get some attention because they are out there being photographed, going online, having the paparazzi pictures on the cover of People, something like that, I think would make a huge difference, just as it did in 1774.
Well, Kimberly Chrisman Campbell, a facet of history I'd never considered. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kimberly Chrisman Campbell is a fashion historian, and she wrote an article for The Atlantic called How Fashion Helped Defeat 18th Century Anti-Vaxxers. She's got a book coming out this February, Fashion Victims, Dress at the Court of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. You can find links to read her article and more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Are you worried on a day like today that missing school is going to set your kids back? Well, don't. We're going to hear the case for more snow days when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's every kid's nightmare, waking up to find 6 or 7 inches of fresh snow covering the roads, only to find out that for some inexplicable reason, school is still on. It is the Yankee way to press on and go about our business, whatever the weather, after all. Plus, canceling school is tough on working parents. And then there's all those missed lessons. One researcher proposes that schools may be better off closing their doors than persevering. Before this week's big storm, we spoke to Joshua Goodman, assistant professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, about the upside of snow days, and it seems all the more appropriate today. So why might students be better off academically not going to school during inclement weather?
That's right. So I think the answer is, and I should preface this by saying that I was a public high school teacher, a math teacher for a couple of years before becoming an academic. When you cancel school, it's obviously disruptive to families in all sorts of ways, but it's actually not very hard for a teacher to deal with, because all that means for a teacher is you push your lesson plans back a day, and when the kids come back to school, they're all in the same place where you left them, roughly. What's much harder to deal with is if you keep school open and because of the snow, 5 of your kids are absent. And then you have to figure out, well, do I keep going with my lesson plan and teach the 20 kids who are here? And if that's the case, what do I do with the 5 kids when they come back to school the next day? And that's the kind of challenge that I think is actually harder for teachers to deal with, sort of coordinating absent students.
That's like 20% of the class. You know, that's significant.
That's right. Well, yeah. So I should say that, what I was finding in my data is that when schools would stay open during snowy weather, it usually caused something like 2 or 3 students to be absent who wouldn't have otherwise. And even that's enough to be challenging for a teacher to deal with and take time away from the regular flow of the classroom.
So the key you're saying is keep them all in the same place academically. Now, did your data find this true across the board, across the socioeconomic spectrum, for example?
Yeah, no, it seems like this phenomenon is fairly widespread. And I will say, I think, I did this study here in Massachusetts, and I think, schools and teachers in Massachusetts are probably particularly used to dealing with snow days. I think the situation would be different when you have places like last year, I think Atlanta had to shut down for a long period of time, and they were shocked because they'd never dealt with sort of snow and that kind of bad weather. So I do think those of us in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire are a little bit used to dealing with snow, and so that means that closing schools is not quite as disruptive to classrooms as it might otherwise be.
I was thinking in rural areas in New Hampshire where longer distances are traveled, maybe you'd have more kids out if the weather was better.
That's true. So my research certainly does suggest that that if you're in a place where keeping school open means you'd only get half of your students showing up, that it's not clear that that's a great idea. I should be clear that my study was really about, how much they're learning and what kind of test scores they get at the end of the year. Test scores are not the only thing we care about when we run schools. We care about taking care of kids. We care about allowing parents to go to their jobs. And of course, you know, one major thing here is we care about student safety. So I actually wouldn't think that test scores and student learning are the first thing that schools and superintendents should think about when deciding about closing or keeping schools open. I just think they should keep it in mind as sort of one of many things that they should be thinking about.
How about just a better system of catching kids up when they've missed time?
I think that's it's an absolutely wonderful point. So it's tough for teachers to catch kids who've been absent up with the material. One thing that I think will change over time, and I think has changed in schools, is now that schools are getting better and better about using the internet to allow parents to check on, you know, kids' progress and sort of whether they've turned in homeworks. It might be that, you know, at some point we live in a world where even if school shuts down or a kid is absent and sitting at home, the teacher can still send them part of the assignment to actually do. And so there might be ways in which technology is going to help us deal with these disruptions to classrooms.
I'm also wondering if they could attend class remotely, which would be possible for a lot of connected kids.
That's right. So, right, I, in theory, you could set up some kind of, you know, Skype session where put some iPads in, you know, and apps in desks that are empty. Although I have to say, as a teacher, I would find that very disruptive to have 20 live students and 5, you know, images of kids being beamed from other places. That might be challenging to deal with.
So in closing, Joshua, any advice for school superintendents who are making these kind of decisions? Can you quantify, you know, how much snow is too much, you know, how little?
No, I don't think I want to draw any bright lines here, but I actually think the point that schools should think very carefully about exactly what you said, which is how do we as a school and we as teachers deal with kids who are absent and missing time? I think that's actually the key question here, is if we can come up with better ways to help catch kids up, that will actually solve a lot of the challenges that I outlined in this research.
Joshua Goodman, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Joshua Goodman, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You can find a link to read his study, Flaking Out, Snowfall Disruptions and Instruction Time and Student Achievement. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, if you've lost power or you're trapped inside looking for something to entertain the family, a board game is usually a pretty good bet, unless you choose the wrong one. From Monopoly to Candyland, we'll get the stats on the tabletop games with the worst user ratings.
Yeah, so Monopoly is kind of a bête noire of these serious gamers. It has a lot of these negative qualities.
That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Sorry.
It's the game of
sorry.
First you're way ahead, then you get bumped
sorry.
Way back. So shake a leg, and you'll get home first.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You may have fond memories of growing up playing Monopoly, Sorry, or Chutes and Ladders, or maybe not. Turns out that some of the most popular board games of all time actually rank among the worst when it comes to user ratings. Oliver Rader is senior writer at 538, and he crunched the numbers and joins us now to reveal which games are bad, why they're bad, and what we should be playing instead. Oliver, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So how does one calculate just how good or bad a game is?
Well, I use data from a very popular board gaming website called Board Game Geek. And they have a database of about 75,000 games. It's sort of a trip advisor for board games. Most of the people who log on and rate games on this site, as you can imagine, are fairly serious gamers. And things that they like are, yeah, basically games that keep players engaged. So a game like Monopoly, for example, you can go bankrupt. You can get eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's seen as a bad thing. So games that keep players engaged and players kind of always think they have a chance to win. I would say that's probably the most important characteristic a game can have.
You said it's so funny to hear you say gamers, because we normally associate gamers with electronic games. They have a different definition in this kind of board game renaissance.
Yeah, exactly. And I think renaissance is the right word. I wrote in a piece on 538 that we're in sort of a golden age of board games. And so, yeah, every year there's more and more of these tabletop games, and every year they seem to get better. Every year the average rating of games goes up and up. So, yeah, we're really in a golden age of board games.
Mm-hmm. So back to the ratings, which are some of the worst offenders, and why do you suspect they rate so badly? You mentioned Monopoly. Someone gets kicked out and the game could still go on for hours.
Yeah, so Monopoly is kind of a bête noire of these serious gamers. It has a lot of these negative qualities, and a lot of the worst games are actually games that most people have heard of and even played. So things like The Game of Life, Candyland, Snakes and Ladders, and the card game War. And the thing that these games have in common is they're reliant entirely on luck.
Hmm.
So in Candyland, you're just randomly drawing these colored cards. In Snakes and Ladders, you're subject to the whim of the dice, and players don't have a chance to really make any meaningful decisions.
Mm-hmm. So there's no strategy involved.
Exactly. And actually, another of the worst games that I found is Tic-Tac-Toe. and there's no luck in Tic-Tac-Toe, and there is a bit of strategy, but it's trivial strategy, right? If the players are above the age of, say, 5, the game's going to end in a draw.
So any idea why games like Monopoly, which have been so popular, by its claim, you know, the most popular board game in the world, given the bad ratings?
I think that's a great question. I think, you know, just through whatever sort of quirks of history, you know, culture and commerce, that these games have just become cultural touchstones, really. So everyone has a copy of Monopoly in their closet, it seems. And I would also argue that, you know, these games are objectively bad, but they're also important, right? I think gaming is important. Candyland might teach a child, you know, how to win or lose with grace and the value of sort of healthy competition. And, you know, kids can start with these games and can hopefully move on to something a little better.
Now, do you think there's any value to the tradition of playing a game like Monopoly? I mean, you know, sort of board game hazing, I guess.
Well, I think, you know, it's just sort of one of these cultural experiences. You know, we sort of talk about bad movies, right? And that's just as much fun as maybe talking about a good movie. So I think playing Monopoly and sort of experiencing this collective agony of going bankrupt, I think that can be very important.
So what are some of the good games that we should be playing instead of these uninspired chestnuts?
Well, I talked to the creator of the best game on Board Game Geek, and this is a game called Twilight Struggle.
Hmm.
And it's quite a departure from Candyland. So in this game, one of us plays as the Americans, one of us plays as the Soviets, and we sort of play out the Cold War.
Wow.
So Candyland, this is not. and actually, in a piece I wrote recently, I looked at specifically some of the best games for kids, sort of anti-monopolies. And just the variety of great games for kids is really mind-boggling. So some of the standouts are a game called Coconuts, where players fling tiny toy coconuts, sort of a dexterity game. And then there's a game called Dixit, where it's sort of a creative storytelling game. And there's, card games, abstract strategy games, really anything you can imagine, you can find a great game about it.
Well, Oliver, for your research, you crunched the numbers, but did you do any test driving of games like Coconuts or Bixit?
Well, I actually got Twilight Struggle for Christmas, so I was able to play the best game in the world for the first time.
What do you think? Does it deserve its title?
It was great. I was the Americans, and I won the Cold War and avoided nuclear Armageddon.
Did you get to say, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall or anything?
I should have. That was clearly a wasted opportunity.
I had one question. Like, can somebody win Twilight Struggle if you're Russian? I mean, they really didn't win the Cold War. I guess this doesn't go by historical fact.
That's right. Yeah, we're sort of recreating history. And actually, the Soviets have an advantage, according to Ananda Gupta, who's the game's co-creator. So the Soviets have an advantage early in the Cold War, and then the Americans will have an advantage late, and that's sort of the balance that the game tries to strike.
Well, Oliver Rader, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Oliver Rader, senior writer at 538. Now, we do have a link to read his article on the best and worst board games, with, of course, being 538, some wonderful little graphs and info charts. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
I play Monopoly with my kids. That's really fun. My 9-year-old, she can totally do Monopoly. The 6-year-old actually totally gets how the game works, but she's not emotionally developed enough to handle her inevitable loss in every game of Monopoly, because a Monopoly loss is dark. It's heavy. It's not like when you lose at, you know, Candyland. Oh, you got stuck in the fudgy thing, baby. Oh, well, you're in the gummy twirlios and you didn't get to win. But when she loses at Monopoly, I gotta look at her little face and I go, okay, so here's what's gonna happen now, okay? All your property, everything you have, all the railroads, your houses, all your money, that's mine now. Gotta give it all to me. No? Give it to me, that's right. And no, you can't play anymore, see, because even though you're giving me all of that, it doesn't even touch how much you owe me. Doesn't even touch it, baby. You're going down hard, it's really bad. All you've been working for all day, I'm gonna take it now, and I'm gonna use it to destroy your sister. I mean, I'm gonna ruin her. It's just mayhem on this board for her now.
Board games, good or bad, do seem to hold an essential place in our childhood memories, but there is another just as important type of game that kids love to play, one that doesn't require boards or cards or a rule book. In fact, all you need to play is a pair of hands and your vocal cords. Julie Sabatier, host and producer of Destination DIY, has more.
When it comes to DIY, doing it yourself doesn't have to mean doing it all by yourself. In fact, some of the most creative DIY projects are the kind that can only be accomplished when people work together. Oral history is a great example. It's passed down from person to person, generation to generation. The culture of children has its own oral traditions in the form of hand-clapping games. The rhymes may change a little with each generation, but they have some amazing staying power. Maybe it's because we start learning them at such a young age.
Patty cake. Patty cake, bake us man, bake me a cake as fast as you can.
This is Sophia Presnell. She's 3 years old.
Roll it, pat it, mark it with a B, put it in the oven for baby and me.
Most children learn patty cake from their parents or teachers.
I want it from Mama.
When they get a little older, kids start to teach other kids more complex games.
Mama, Mama, can't you see what this baby's done to me? Took away my MTV. Now I'm watching Barney. Don't stop till your hands get red. Starting right now.
I visited the Boys and Girls Club in Northeast Portland, where I recorded this group of girls.
Hi, my name is Tajay.
My name is Kones, and I'm 11 years old.
My name is Jada.
My name is Deshauna.
My name is Demaya.
They were all between the ages of 9 and 11, and they knew a lot of hand-clapping rhymes. There was a group of high school girls there who said they'd outgrown these games, but when I asked them what they remembered, it wasn't long before they were giggling, singing, and clapping.
Shake, shake, shake to the rhythm of tape. We're gonna rock to the tree top all day long. Puffing and puffing and singing that song. All little birds on neighbor street. Let me hear the rock and roll, tweet, tweet, tweet. Rock and roll, tweet, tweet. Tweet, elite, rock and roll, tweet, tweet. Tweet, elite. Moms in the kitchen, bread and rice. Dad's in the corner, shooting at dice. Brothers in jail, ringing that bell. Sisters in the corner, a fruit cocktail. Rock and roll, tweet, tweet. Tweet, elite, rock and roll, tweet, tweet. Tweet, elite.
When I asked the girls what makes them want to play these games, they all pretty much said the same thing.
When you super-de-duper bored and there's nothing else to do, you just break out some pen games.
Educator Karen Ellis says there's a lot more to it than that. She's the curator of the National Children's Folk Song Repository, which is part of her website, the Educational Cyber Playground. When she was a classroom teacher, she asked kids to show her their hand clapping games.
And I rhythmically and melodically wrote all that information down and learned everything they taught me. And turned around at some point, and this was over a few years, at some point I turned around and started to use all of the information, all the poetry, for their reading curriculum. I managed to raise everybody's reading level a few years in a very, very short amount of time.
Karen has collected all kinds of teaching materials and studies about the link between hand games and child development. She's also created a place where people can preserve the songs and chants they remember from childhood.
1, 2, 3. Down by the banks of the hankety-pank, when the bullfrogs jump from bank to bank. With the eats, ops, oops, ops, he's got the little with the big curve-plops.
You're out! You're out!
Most girls and a few boys play these games at some point in their lives. And they aren't something you just forget when you grow up. I got two women I know to participate in a little experiment. Stephanie Lawson and Alicia Sullivan are both in their late 20s, and they grew up on opposite sides of the country. They didn't know each other before they came into the studio, but they found they knew a lot of the same hand games.
Miss Susie had a steamboat. The steamboat had a bell.
Toot, toot.
Sweet! Miss Susie went to heaven.
I think it skips the third one in that.
Okay, it skips the third one.
The steamboat went to hello, operator. Please give me number 9. And if you disconnect me, I'll kick you from behind the refrigerator. There was a piece of glass, Miss Susie sat upon it, and broke her little ass. Me no more questions, and tell me no more lies. The boys are in the bathroom, zipping up their flies are in the meadow. Oh,
according to Karen Ellis, these games have their roots in 19th century Europe. Kids around the world continue to play hand-clapping games in English, Spanish, Creole, and other languages. And this cooperative cultural tradition has spread across geographic boundaries.
You can find a game song in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, and you can find the same one in South Philly. And that connectedness, the physicality of it, just hitting your hands and hitting them in time and sharing all of that together is really how it stays alive. And it's organic. And that's why it's stayed intact for hundreds of years. Miss Mary Mack is everywhere, but that doesn't mean that it's this done exactly the same way everywhere.
You know, like this, Miss Mary Mack, 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 all dressed in black, 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 and with silver buns, 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 all down her back, back, back. She asked her mother, mother, mother for 50 cents, 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 to see the elephant, elephant, elephant drop over the...
If you want to visit Karen Ellis's Cyber Playground and add the rhymes you remember to the National Children's Folk Song Repository, there's a link on our website, destinationdiy.org.
And that piece was produced by Julie Sabatier, host of Destination DIY. Thanks so much for listening today. If you are trapped at home or maybe venturing outside on this blizzardy day, send us a photograph of what you're doing. You can post it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth. After all, there's plenty to share, even if tucked into our own little cabins waiting for the fever to set in. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our interns
Fiona Shea
and Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.